Today, Scotland's political landscape looks very different. Labour have made an astonishing return under Keir Starmer, winning their biggest ever majority in any general election. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has resigned, and the Conservative Party are in chaos. Meanwhile, Scottish Tory leader Douglas Ross is also out after failing to win his seat. But the biggest story in Scotland is just as the Tories have been decimated, the SNP have taken an extraordinary blow, losing all but nine of their seats at Westminster. Have the party become as toxic as the Tories? We examine just what went wrong and what could happen next. My name's Lorna Hughes. This is Planet Holyrood.
It's important we look at the facts.
Politics has to be about service.
A modern form of national service.
The outcome, that's for the voters to decide.
Right, the Conservatives are today facing their worst election result in recent history as Keir Starmer's Labour Party romp home with their biggest ever majority. So they have 411 seats to the Tories, 119. So the public have made their views crystal clear. But perhaps the biggest shock is in Scotland, with the SNP almost decimated, losing 38 seats, holding on to just nine. So we're going to pick through the bones of the last few hours. But John, what's your reaction?
So it's clearly been a terrible night for the Conservative Party. But yeah, in Scotland, the really big story is the fall of the SNP. There was mixed opinion polls in the lead up to the election, and they were showing anything between sort of 10 seats up to 37 seats. So the outcome has been right at the bottom end, you know, pretty much the worst case scenario for John Swinney. And he's going to need to decide what he's going to do to rebuild the party. Now, I think both the Conservatives and the SNP have paid the price of being the party that was in power during the worst cost of living crisis and living memory, and you know, after the amount of years that they've been running their respective governments, the scandals mount up, the incompetencies mount up, and politics goes in cycles, and they're both paying the price both for their time in government and the mistakes that they've made there.
I don't think you can underestimate the kicking that the Tories have got down in England and in Scotland, which isn't that surprising. We knew that it was going to be very difficult. But I think the shock of the SNP, it is incredible. I mean, it looks like that they have become almost as toxic as the Tories in England, which, just a few months ago, we would never have believed. Hannah, you know, was it real jaw-dropping stuff for you last night?
Yes, it was, until I eventually threw in the towel and had to go to my bed. But I think even during the night, I woke up and kind of like sleepily looked at my phone. So I'm not entirely sure how much sleep I've had. But yeah, I think, you know, as John is saying, in Scotland, the big story really is the SNP. And, you know, as we see quite often with results like this, the people who've lost their seats, who are very angry about it, they first of all will blame their party and individuals within the party, and then they'll start to blame the voters. And I think actually they just need to sort of look at themselves as part of the problem as well. We've seen, miraculously, Stephen Flynn has managed to hold on to his seat. Pete Wishart, I think I'd said this last night on our live broadcast about the fact that I thought he was probably quite, you know, certain to hold on to his, and he has. But, you know, the whole of Glasgow just completely wiped out, the whole of, well, Edinburgh, some really significant wins there. I just think the SNP, you know, John Swinney is speaking this morning, and I'm just kind of, as we're on air, so I'm just kind of looking at what he's saying, but he's talking about needing to listen to voters on independence. I have to accept we failed to convince people of the urgency of independence, and therefore we need to take time to consider and reflect how we deliver our commitment to independence. You know, that is a very kind of strange thing to admit to, I think, because the SNP, the whole point of the SNP is independence. But now, you know, maybe by them not putting that so predominantly in the campaign, even though it was page one, line one of the manifesto, most of the campaign seemed to be about Brexit and the cost of living, which you can see why they did it, because those are the issues that people are you know, are on people's minds, I suppose.
But do you not think, Hannah, it's possible? I mean, what my take on it was that the SNP were being punished by both sides of the electorate, punished by independence supporters who they haven't delivered independence for. In fact, they've been nowhere near it. It may have been the first line in the manifesto, but you know, we've seen nothing in the last few years. So I can understand a righteous anger from them. Mm. And then you have the other side who, you know, are looking at the SNP failing to actually govern properly is what, you know, they're looking at. And then we need to send a message to them. Now, I think it has to be both of those things, but you are right to look at it just from, we haven't managed to deliver, you know, the message of independence well enough. Well, you know, there'd be plenty of people who would say govern properly, first of all.
Well, yeah.
And stop talking to yourself.
Yeah. I think as well, one of the you know, mistakes I think the SNP made in this campaign was focusing on Brexit, because actually we've seen, you know, various polls, etc., showing that, you know, while people acknowledge Brexit as a problem, it's not one of the top issues. And the SNP seemed almost, you know, insistent on inserting Brexit into the campaign and into the discussion when no one else was really talking about it. You know, yes, I'm sure there's many people, particularly in Scotland, who would like to reverse Brexit, but I think a lot of people have accepted that that's not going to be something that can be done straight away. You know, it's not something in the short term or even medium term. So it seemed a bit of a strange choice to really go in so hard on Brexit and you know, leave independence, I guess, by the wayside. But on your point about, you know, basically the SNP being punished for years of, you know, what some people would say is incompetent governance, I think that's right. You know, and then obviously the party's got its own internal problems as well, so that's all kind of compounded to create this result today. And I think John Swinney, you know, there are some calls from, say, activists, nobody sort of prominent within the SNP, but there are some calls for him to resign. I think those are maybe a bit premature, given that he literally was only in the door before the election was called. But I think he has an absolutely mammoth task now to sort of unite the party and get it back on some sort of, you know, directory that is not this flailing around blaming other people and also making horrific mistakes in government.
Yeah, I mean, John, I think that's the thing. I mean, interestingly, what the SNP now need to do is exactly what Labour did when, you know, they literally went down to one seat in Scotland and obviously did poorly in England. They need to really look at themselves and sort out their party. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think it would be a mistake for the SNP to take from this that they are being punished for not focusing enough on the fight for Scottish independence. I mean, it's the polls on independence are interesting. It does appear that half people would like Scotland to be an independent country, but I think that the proportion of people who want a political party that leads the Scottish government to be focused on that to the exclusion of other things will be far, far smaller. I don't really believe that they are being punished for a lack of progress and independence. I think they're being punished for the things that you mentioned earlier, a failure to deliver on all of these things that they promised 10 years ago in terms of reducing child poverty and generally making people's lives better. I think that they're being punished for a combination of the failure to deliver on all of these policy areas, you know, the ferry scandal, the NHS waiting times, the bottle return scheme failures, the list is endless.
A9,
and you have that compounded by, and I think you really can't underestimate the impact of the well-documented legal issues that the party has internally. I think that they're being punished for that, the independence.
Well, I think
when it splits people off, you've got some people for whom it's the only issue, but equally, I think the vast majority of people, it's something that they might aspire to, but they don't want it to be the sole focus of Scottish politics.
Do you not think as well, it's quite interesting because, you know, before last night, we were talking about, oh, will ALBA pick up some more votes? You know, if people are disenfranchised with the SNP, will they go to the Greens or ALBA as a sort of protest vote? And yeah, we've seen actually the Greens do pretty well in Scotland in some, you know, areas. However, ALBA, you know, it's been embarrassing for them. I think they've had, well, the last time I looked, it was around 11 or 12,000 votes in the whole country, and they fielded, I think, 19 candidates.
I think that's a reflection of independence really was the be-all and end-all for the majority of the Scottish electorate. Then you would have saw that vote a lot higher. I mean, it's very interesting. One of the other votes that's gone up significantly across the whole of the UK is the Liberal Democrat vote, which suggests that actually the Brexit issue is a big thing for a lot of people.
Do you not think it's maybe people decided they couldn't vote Tory, they didn't want to vote Labour, and that's why they've benefited? I mean, you know, the other story is reform as well, and that includes in Scotland, which, you know, a lot of the political elite and certain of the media as well did not believe that there would be people voting for reform, but they have.
Yeah, I mean, so, it's funny, the reform thing, that in one hand they've got 4 MPs, so you need to keep it in perspective that got the same amount of MPs, I think, as the Greens. But yeah, I mean, it's the bigger picture is that it's a massive, massive problem for the Conservative Party. Really, interestingly, in Scotland, Labour have had a huge rebound. In England, figures show that the Labour vote has stayed more or less the same. What has been an utter disaster for the Conservatives has been the rise of reform and the splintering off of that right-wing vote into the sort of more moderate centrist Conservatives and the extreme right of the party have gone to reform in droves.
Yeah.
I mean, I think all parties really should be looking at themselves and looking what, you know, they believe and stop talking to themselves. And, you know, they really need to actually look at what the voters have said. Now, you know, if Keir Starmer doesn't deliver some of the things that he has said and fast, then we know, we've talked about this, that in 2026, you know, things could not be as bad for the SNP, but they really need to take control now. I mean, in terms of what actually happened, if you had to pick one single thing that you believe or think that the voters looked at and went, you know what, I'm not voting for the SNP, I can't do it, or I am, you know, going to vote Labour, what do you think it could have been? I mean, we've listed a whole litany of things. Is it on governance? Is it on something to do with independence? Or is it on what could be perceived as them being sometimes no better than the Tory party in terms of not being held to account, not, you know, actually taking control when something in their party goes wrong, pretending it didn't happen. I mean, I don't think people like that very much.
No, they don't. One thing is certain is people notice when it appears that political parties are, you know, have got too much power and they're sort of overreaching with that in terms of, you know, to support their own mates, etc. And I think we saw that obviously with the SNP and the Michael Matheson issue. And even though that was before the election and Michael Matheson is not standing for Westminster or anything like that, I think that had a huge impact on, you know, trust, especially in the way John Swinney then reacted to it, you know. And John Swinney was not First Minister when all this emerged, but yet he somehow managed to make it even worse. You know, but I think people do not like that, and they don't like being taken for granted. And I think that, you know, on a UK level and a Scotland level, people do feel as if they're being taken for granted, and, you know, these parties have just run away with the power that they had, and they're not being held accountable. And this is kind of the first chance that people have had to say, actually, enough.
John, is there one single thing for you?
I mean, I guess from a certain point of view, that what's happened to the SNP is just the same story of any party that's ever had power, who's ever been in government in recent political history, that you get 10 or so years and then people become fed up and they see the cracks, and they feel that the party in power has become complacent and they reject them. But I think that really for the SNP, so I mean, they were always going to be fighting that going into this election and the next election, just that natural political gravity. But I think that really on top of that has been this lethal combination of there being so many clear examples of incompetence in government, and it's the coupling of that with the legal issues that they're facing in terms of the internal party finances. I think it's that combination. And to be honest, if you are asking me to say which single one, I think it's probably that police investigation that's ongoing into the finances of the SNP.
I would agree with you, but I'm going to say something that at the time, because it was your story, John, that I found shocking, which was Nicola Sturgeon's deletion of WhatsApp apps along with John Swinney and, you know, and others. I think the trouble is that while the Tories did it and, you know, other parties did it as well, you know, she stood up and she'd been standing up all throughout COVID, being very clear, you know, being the best communicator and delivering, you know, messages, the right messages to Scotland. And she was unequivocal when she was asked that in any inquiry, everything, you know, would be there. To find that out, you know, as an editor, you both know my reaction to that. I was staggered. And I don't think you can underestimate, you know, everything around COVID. When you can't have, you know, people at your parents' funeral, when your elderly relatives are, you know, in a care home that you can't get in to see, you know, when all of us made so many sacrifices, and she led well, and yet she did that. So therefore, you have a higher position to fall from.
And I think as well, like we saw down in England, I didn't see so much in Scotland, but people were like tweeting selfies and things from the polling station saying, you know, I'm doing this for, you know, my gran because I couldn't get to see her and I had to say goodbye to her on Zoom. And, you know, so that obviously that the pandemic was such a significant moment in people's lives that people do remember the actions of those politicians, and they probably won't forget them for a very, very long time. You know, so I think actually, Lorna, you know, you're probably right in that. I think that even though the pandemic was some time ago, it's still so painful for so many people and the damage that that did, and what we're subsequently finding out about the actions of politicians, you know, it can't be underestimated. But also I think it's interesting because, you know, for a long time under Nicola Sturgeon, the SNP had almost like a mantra that we are better than them. You know, we are not Westminster, we are not the Tories. These people are repugnant, and, you know, we are almost like taking the moral high ground, that we are better, that we're more sort of advanced or, you know, progressive. And to see that they've actually just been doing the exact same thing, you know, I think the problem as well for Nicola Sturgeon is she fell from a much higher point than someone like Boris Johnson, because Boris Johnson didn't put himself on that pedestal of saying, you know, I am almost superior to others. And when you put yourself in that position and you fall short, you really, really fall short.
I think that's,
we will,
right,
be judged harshly.
You were, the whole idea of the party and of Nicola Sturgeon was that they were meant to be better than that. And then, you know, we saw that they weren't. They were doing exactly the same thing. And it was hugely damaging.
Yeah, and just briefly before we get into the kind of details of, you know, who won, who lost across all the parties in Scotland, you know, Nicola Sturgeon was obviously front and centre on ITV last night. And, you know, she had to face that, which must have been very difficult. Mm. But very interestingly, she was using the words, she was calling the SNP they, not we. Now, she's currently still a serving MSP and a member of the SNP, you know, and though that was the language that she was using, and again, you're still seeing then her distancing herself from that.
Yeah.
So, you know, that is, people see that.
I think it was a massive mistake to go on the programme, because there's no way really that she could have come out, she's going to come out of that looking good either. She's going to have to, on live television, accept responsibility, a large part of responsibility for what happened to the SNP last night, or she's going to do what she did, which is to sort of try to distance herself from this catastrophe and pretend that had she still been in charge, perhaps the outcome would have been different, which I think we all know is absolute baloney. So I think, you know, it's a very short-term, silly thing to do to go on the television and commentate on the outcome of an election that really you're not a bystander. You're hugely a part of this terrible night for the SNP and responsible really for most of the problems that people were voting on last night.
I think you're right. And one of the most uncomfortable moments, and I'll be brief, but was, you know, Joanna Cherry obviously lost her seat. We'll talk about others. And she was being interviewed and Sturgeon was sitting there and she let rip effectively to Sturgeon.
Joanna Cherry let rip?
Yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Never.
Yeah, never. But what was interesting to me was that, you know, we do know that obviously Joanna Cherry was on a collision course with Nicola Sturgeon for a very long time, you know, but, you know, Joanna Cherry's on record saying that Sturgeon never addressed, you know, any of the issues with her directly, never spoke to her, whatever. Now, Joanna Cherry got her chance to speak directly to Nicola Sturgeon, who was sitting in an ITV news studio. And it was fascinating because she was stony-faced while Joanna Cherry said that, yes, the blame for some of this has got to rest with previous first ministers. And, you know, and also Ian Blackford as well. So
I think, though, Joanna Cherry, you know, she does like to moan. It's no secret. I got the feeling that she has been waiting to say exactly that for a very long time. And I think, to be honest, you know, Nicola Sturgeon, she has been a thorn in the side of Nicola Sturgeon for years and years and years. So I think Nicola Sturgeon's reaction was kind of expected, because she's like, well, you know.
I know, but
something like that.
You know, is Jana not right? And is it not fair that she gets that opportunity to say that? I mean, it's interesting because obviously this is all over a lot of this is over the GRR bill, which some people say, you know, was part of the downfall of Nicola Sturgeon.
She's annoyed that, you know, she thinks that the SNP basically should have made her like the poster woman for the whole party, because she took on the Supreme Court in the prorogation case. You know, she keeps banging on about that. And I think, you know, Joanna Cherry does like to be the centre of attention, and we saw that again last night.
I think it's certainly interesting, because I think, you know, the party, and at the moment that does include obviously Nicola Sturgeon, and you know, does need to look at all of this and you know, all of the people who were dissenters, all of the people who were asking questions, and you know, actually consider where, you know, where we wrong. I mean, the other big story obviously as well is Douglas Ross, and obviously the seat that he parachuted himself into, he has now lost, and the SNP obviously put a lot of their resources into that. I mean, this now means that the Tory party in Scotland do not have a leader, and he doesn't have a seat at Westminster. John, how do you think that's going to play out for the Tory party in Scotland?
Yeah, I mean, it's just another disaster, isn't it? Interestingly, like, as we speak, Rishi Sunak's making a speech in the steps of Downing Street, in which he's expected to resign as well. So the Tory party really are now completely rudderless. There's a collection of misfits that are going to be lining up to try to become the leader, to drag the party off to the right. And that's the big story, is going to be whether they choose that direction or try to, you know, go for a possibly Jeremy Hunt as a centrist candidate. So, yeah, in Scotland, the Douglas Ross parachuted himself into this seat, saying that he wanted to lead from the front and that he was doing the right thing by his party. Absolute disaster. He's effectively stamped all over an ill colleague. And who knows what might have happened in that seat there is perhaps a chance that Duguid could have actually won there. So it's kind of sums up what a disastrous night this has been for the Conservatives, and how they've kind of brought this upon themselves with their own selfishness.
Yeah.
I mean, Hannah, say you know, the party decided that you know, David Duguid wasn't able, and that's what they did, to stand. Do you think, had they put somebody else in there, another Tory candidate other than Ross, then they might have actually held on to it? Do you think it's Douglas Ross was the problem and what he did?
Well, yes and no. I think that Douglas Ross is a high profile, you know, one of the most high profile Scottish Tories, and there have been various sort of questions around, you know, the fact that he's got three jobs, his expenses for those jobs, etc. But I think it's actually not about who replaced David as the candidate. I think it's the way that it was done. You know, the fact that the rug was pulled out from under David Duguid, you know, without him even really knowing. And then he hasn't kept his mouth shut about it. He's made it quite clear that he's unhappy about the decision, that he had been planning to stand. And I think just that, the optics, if you, I hate that word, but the optics of it, just look bad. It makes them look as if they're all sort of, you know, greedy and selfish, and they're willing to stab one of their own colleagues just to try and, you know, to take the job. So I think if there had been more of a sort of discussion, an agreement, an explanation with David prior to, you know, announcing who was going to be the candidate, it could have been very different. But I think that played a huge role in that area because people were unhappy. And I actually think David was quite a kind of well-liked MP. He was quite a good local MP. So, yeah, I don't know if it's really so much to do with Douglas Ross as a person or if it's to do with the way that David was treated.
And the other, you know, let's, we can talk about England as well, but, you know, who are the... Who did you see? Who are the biggest losers as well down south? I mean, we obviously saw a lot of the Tories that were the architects behind a lot of the stuff that was going on down there lose their seats to sometimes joyful scenes of, you know, joyful and partying. You know, we have seen some massive names up here obviously lose their seats. Kirsten Oswald lost hers. We have all of Glasgow, for the first time in over 20 years, has gone back to red. And, you know, we are left with, I think it's quite interesting, the SNP MPs that we're left with, who are perhaps not the ones that necessarily people would want to be left with. But we have Chris Law, who's obviously in Dundee and hung on, the man who lives in a castle. And, you know, we have Pete Wishart, as you said, who hung on to, you know, Perthshire as well. I mean, who, there are others that, you know, like Chris Stevens, who are really good local MPs. I mean, who will be missed? Alison Thewlis as well. You know, John, who were you surprised at going? And who... would you have, you know, who, which ones actually made you kind of sit up and go, crikey, that's quite a shock?
Yeah, I mean, some of the names that you've mentioned, I think one of the other things is some of the names that not many people would recognise who have gone, people that were, you know, just sort of SNP apparatchiks that were, had been just... appear to have been hanging about in Westminster doing not very much. One of the things I think it was quite good to see was that Stephen Flynn won his seat because I think he's generally, he's been pretty good in the Commons. An interesting thing there will be, given that he has won, whether he will be content to stay there or whether at the Holyrood elections he'll be looking to come back up here, because he's one of the people who's viewed as being the main, one of the main contenders to become the leader of the SNP, something that is unlikely to be able to do from Westminster.
And I mean, with John Nicholson obviously lost his seat, Alan Smith lost his seat as well. You know, as you say, he is probably the most high profile as leader of the SNP in Westminster to remain. But as Hannah, as you were pointing out yesterday to me, he will no longer have the profile down there that he's had.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Lib Dems will now get, you know, the two questions at PMQs every week. The SNP won't, you know, they just won't really get a look in. So therefore, you know, that has a knock-on impact in the SNP in Scotland as well, because I think what the SNP, whether you agree with it or not, what they did quite effectively was use that PMQs session to essentially berate Westminster and blame Westminster for all the things that were going wrong in Scotland. And Stephen Flynn had a platform to do that on, you know, national television every single week, and they're not going to have that anymore. So I think they're sort of opportunities to publicly blame Westminster in such a sort of, you know, well-publicised manner are going to be significantly reduced. But I think as well, just on your question about the sort of big names I was surprised about, you know, people, obviously Liz Truss Jacob Rees-Mogg.
Liz you know, Truss's reaction was one of the best. She just walked straight off the stage without saying a thing.
I do love this picture of Jacob Rees-Mogg beside this...
The baked beans man.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's kind of... There's things like this, which is why we love elections, because they can throw up, you know, unexpected moments of hilarity. I also think Nadine Dorries. I don't know if anyone saw Nadine Dorries on Channel 4, but...
That's she lost the plot a bit again.
Well, did she even have the plot in the first place? I don't know. But, you know, like, she was quite amusing. And, yeah, I think Rishi Sunak is probably one of the only Tory MPs who wishes they hadn't kept their seat, because now he has to go and deal with all of this. you know.
Do you think he will be resigning?
I think he'll be exiting. He may well be doing it as we...
Yeah, I think he is. He's resigning. But
so
you know,
who on earth are they going to put in charge?
It's fascinating, isn't it? Because most of the big names that you would have expected to be going for the leadership are gone now, and we're left with people like Suella Braverman.
And there's people already in the Tories who are saying, if Suella Braverman becomes leader, I will be leaving. Yeah. You know, so even the people who've managed to hold on to their seats are now threatening to quit already.
It's a huge moment for the Conservatives, isn't it? Because they either veer off to the right and pander to reform, or they come back to the centre and try to compete with Labour there. And you get the feeling that, you know, they're set up for quite a long time in the wilderness, and part of that is going to be veering off to the right. The interesting thing is that there's so much noise around, like, they've got, you know, that's what they've got to do. They've got to compete with reform. They didn't win because Farage was there with this. And actually, it's all nonsense. What the one thing that British politics over the last 50 years will show you is that parties win from the centre. That's what Labour have just done, and so it's, you know, it's going to be a difficult few years for the Conservatives.
Yeah, it's going to be a very completely changed House of Commons as well. I mean, you know, not just in terms of the numbers and, you know, who's and Keir Starmer as Prime Minister, but the Lib Dems, as Hannah, as you said, you know, there as, you know, opposition, along with the Tories, depending upon what happens and what on earth they do about reform, if anything. The SNP are going to be very much, obviously, in the sidelines too. But we are going to see, you know, we're going to see people, certainly in the Labour front benches, like, you know, we're going to have Angela Rayner, you know, a 44-year-old grandmother, as Deputy Prime Minister. You know, they certainly have the ability to be able to hopefully inspire and change things. It's whether they can do it. Because, you know, as we do know, it may be that if they don't manage it in Scotland, first of all, the first test will be in 2026 at the Holyrood elections. And, you know, if they don't deliver in England, then, you know, we could see another different kind of House of Commons in 5 years' time. Yeah. What's the first thing, Hannah, you would like to see them, the Labour Party, actually do?
That is a good question. I mean, the things that I would like to see them do are things that they've already ruled out doing. You know, for example, scrap the rape clause and the bedroom tax. I think that they do need to make significant sort of movement on this GB energy plan, and they need to, you know, make some indication of how much of that's going to be in Scotland. I think they need to get on with that very quickly. It's hard to say, because again, they have been very sort of smart in not actually giving that much detail about exactly how they're going to go about things. So it's hard to say what you want them to do if they haven't said if they're going to even do it. I don't know. That's a rubbish answer, John. What do you think?
So on the face of it, it looks like Labour have won this stonking majority. It looks like they're in this incredible, or they are in an incredibly powerful position, but there's an underlying story there that actually in England, their share of the vote has remained pretty much the same as it was at the last election. What's happened here has been more a story of a rejection of the Conservatives, just saying Scotland has been a rejection of the SNP rather than a wholehearted embracing of Keir Starmer and Labour. People wanted rid of the Conservatives. And so there could be tough times ahead, I think, for Labour, that they've, if there's anything that really sums up the way Keir Starmer's gone about this campaign, it's just been absolute safety first. If you think back to when he won the leadership, there was talk of nationalising industries and a whole raft of really quite left-wing policies. That's all gradually been replaced with a political slogan, vote Labour for change. The beauty of political slogans is that the more meaningless, the better, because people then fill that slogan with their own hopes and dreams. And that's the dangerous position that Labour are in now. They've been telling everybody for the last few weeks that a vote for them is a vote for change. People have piled their own dreams into that slogan, what they would like to see changing. And it's a potentially very dangerous if they don't now change things in ways that people want to see them change. I think one of the big things that Labour should be doing is to really taking a grown-up look at their trading relationship with Europe. That's probably the single biggest problem that Britain has at the moment, the fact that it's seen as insular and that companies don't want to invest here. There's been a complete breakdown of investment, both from government and from businesses. And that, unfortunately, that's one of the places that Keir Starmer seems quite reluctant to get involved. He said that he doesn't think he sees Britain going back into the single market or the customs union in his lifetime. Now, I suspect he'll shift in that, and it's where he may not go back into these organisations in name, but that he surely understands that there has to be a movement towards greater alignment with Europe in order to get to get growth back in the UK economy. You can talk about how you want to divide up the pie, but if the pie is shrinking all the time, then people's lives are going to be getting worse rather than better. So I think that's the big thing that he needs to start to think about once he gets in the number 10.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be an interesting few days, the next few days, and then we wait and see what happens and the ramifications for Scotland as well. Hannah, John, thank you very much for joining me. And that's it, over. We just wait and see what happens next.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It's important we look at the facts. Politics has to be about service.
A modern form of national service.
The outcome, that's for the voters to decide.